Diagnosis deferred. If that's how your assessment of personality disorders usually looks, tune in. We've got 10 questions that might up your game. Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. 1 in 50 people have borderline personality disorder, but that's not the number you need to know. You need to know how many are in your practice and whether you're over or under diagnosing it. So here are the benchmarks. In the average outpatient practice, 1 in 10 patients have borderline personality disorder. If you work on an inpatient ward, it's twice as common, 1 in 5. And if you work in primary care, it's twice as rare, 1 in 20.
If you're like me, you're probably underdiagnosing borderline personality, but why does that even matter? This month, we featured an interview with Dr. Lois Khoi-Chan, who directs the Gunderson Personality Disorders Institute at Mass General's McLean Hospital, and it changed my practice. In her view, it's not enough to make the diagnosis. We also need to tell the patient that they have borderline personality disorder and what it means. When people understand their vulnerabilities and how their symptoms get triggered by key events in relationships, they can start to build a life worth living. Now, it's not easy to convey all this to a person with borderline personality disorder, and Dr. Khoi-Chan has practical tips in our online interview. Here's a hint. One pitfall is being too careful, walking on eggshells. She recommends talking about the diagnosis in a direct and genuine manner.
Whether you're missing the diagnosis or overdiagnosing it based on your gut impressions, we have 10 questions today that will improve your game. It's the McLean Screening Instrument, and it was developed by Mary Zanarini and colleagues in 2003. Now, there are a lot of screening tests for borderline personality disorder. Most of them are too unwieldy to be useful in everyday practice, but this one isn't. It's a paper and pencil test that the patient fills out with 10 yes or no questions.
And this simple test performed pretty well in a validation study. Its sensitivity and specificity are around 0.8, which is better than what we see with most screening tests in psychiatry. Sensitivity means how sensitive it is at picking up the disorder in someone who actually has it. So 0.8 means 80% sensitive. So 20% of the time, this test is going to miss borderline personality in someone who actually has it. But when a test is very sensitive, like above 70%, it usually does so at a cost of specificity. In other words, it's so sensitive that it overdiagnoses everybody. So what impressed me here is that both the sensitivity and the specificity landed in the 80% range. Specificity means how well the test hones in and gets specific, minimizing false positives and minimizing overdiagnosis. With a score of 0.85 or 85% specificity, this borderline personality disorder screening test is going to mislabel someone with borderline personality who doesn't actually have it about 15% of the time. What's remarkable about those numbers is that other screening tests for borderline have dozens of questions and are not even as accurate as this one. For example, the personality disorder questionnaire is going to be very good at accurately identifying borderline with a specificity of 0.98, but it's not very good at picking it up with a sensitivity of only 0.41. But all these numbers imply that there's a gold standard in diagnosing it, that there's a pathologist out there who can look under the microscope and really tell if someone has borderline personality. Of course, there's not. What they used as the gold standard was the Diagnostic Interview for DSM-IV Personality Disorders, and that might explain why the numbers are so good, because the same authors who developed this short screen also developed the one that it was compared to, the Diagnostic Interview for DSM-IV Personality Disorders. So the questions are similar, it's just that the gold standard one goes into more detail and is rated by a clinician instead of self-rated. So another way of looking at these results is that the short version you're going to hear about today is 80% as good as the long interview.
And that's good news for the practicing psychiatrist, because I'm guessing you don't have the luxury of conducting a lengthy diagnostic interview for borderline personality in every patient. So without further ado, here are the 10 questions, and you can find a link to the actual test in the episode notes. It's online at moodtreatmentcenter.com/measurement. Question 1. Have any of your closest relationships been troubled by a lot of arguments or repeated breakups?
Symptoms of borderline personality disorder come out more in close, intense relationships. These patients seek out those relationships, but those same intimate relationships end up triggering the very symptoms they struggle with. As John Gunderson put it, patients with borderline personality disorder feel that their lives are not worth living unless they feel connected to someone they believe really cares. Often, that caring person is us, their caregiver, and our online interview with Dr. Khoi Chan walks you through how to manage your caregiving relationships with these patients. We'll also have excerpts from that interview in next Monday's podcast.
2. Have you deliberately hurt yourself physically? For example, punched yourself, cut yourself, burned yourself? How about made a suicide attempt?
Self-harm is more common in women with borderline personality disorder, and women actually make up 70% of those who have the disorder. Male patients are more likely to express that aggression outward, breaking things or getting into fights.
3. Have you had at least 2 other problems with impulsivity? Example, eating binges or spending sprees, drinking too much, or verbal outbursts? And 4. Have you been extremely moody?
Those 2 questions cross into the bipolar category with impulsivity and moodiness. And here's an interesting statistic. Despite the rivalry between borderline researchers and bipolar researchers, they align in at least one way. In the mood research, they've found that 38% of patients with bipolar 2 have borderline personality disorder. That's a lot. In the borderline research, the number is the same in reverse. They found that 38% of borderline patients meet the criteria for bipolar 2. So there is a big overlap here, and the overlap is with bipolar 2, not so much with bipolar 1, as those patients are more likely to have stable and healthy personalities when they're not in a mood episode. Another pearl in this research is that most of the overlap between bipolar 2 and borderline personality disorder is due to cyclothymic temperament. And guess what the original word for borderline personality was in the 1970s when they were first sketching out the disorder for DSM-3? It was cycloid personality disorder, and the description of that reads almost exactly like cyclothymic disorder. So it's no coincidence that these 2 have so much in common. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to the is it bipolar or is it borderline dichotomy. More often than not, it's both. Or more specifically, it's a complex overlap of cyclothymic temperament, bipolar 2 moods, and a traumatic or unstable childhood.
5. Have you felt very angry a lot of the time? How about often acted in an angry or sarcastic manner? And 6. Have you often been distrustful of other people?
Borderline patients often talk in a caustically sarcastic manner. When combined with their distrust of us, that acrid sarcasm can elicit intense countertransference reactions. In other words, it's hard to sit with. So if you find yourself the target of a patient's biting sarcasm, just remember, it's a symptom of the disorder.
7. Have you frequently felt unreal, or as if things around you were unreal?
This question maps with criteria 9 in the DSM, transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. Under extreme stress, the patient may have illusions like shadows or feeling the walls are shifting. They may feel like time goes by and they don't know what happened, or have out-of-body states, or overly paranoid ideas like that their coworkers are spying on them. But these are brief, rare, and they don't really rise to the level of full psychosis. We're going to talk about them more in the Word of the Day at the end of this episode.
Eight, have you chronically felt empty?
This symptom distinguishes borderline a bit from bipolar disorder, and it connects it more with trauma, especially neglect. People who are neglected by their parents often struggle with a lifelong emptiness that isn't changed by psychiatric medications, and these patients may cut themselves just to feel something.
9. Have you often felt that you had no idea of who you are or that you have no identity?
Or as DSM puts it, unstable self-image or sense of self. These patients seem inconsistent to others with dramatic shifts in their life goals, values, and religions. This particular symptom can make patients seek out domineering forces to fill up that identity void, things like cults, controlling spouses, or joining the military. Sometimes, though, they strike the right balance in these pursuits, and many a patient with borderline personality disorder will thrive in a rigid and highly structured job like the military, one that keeps their impulsivity and fractured identity at bay. One more thing on identity. It might sound like a symptom that has to do with identity is more on the personality disorder side and less on the bipolar side, but not so much. Remember, the main overlap between borderline and bipolar has to do with the cyclothymic temperament, and cyclothymic was almost placed in the personality disorder section of DSM-3, but it was kept with the mood disorders because it bears a genetic relationship to bipolar. But if you read any descriptive papers on cyclothymic type, you'll find that they mention the same kinds of identity disturbances that we see in borderline. An insecure identity with frequent shifts in religions, hobbies, values, jobs, and romantic partners.
Ten. Have you made desperate efforts to avoid feeling abandoned or being abandoned? Example, repeatedly called someone to reassure yourself that he or she still cared, begged them to not leave you, or clung to them physically.
In the original DSM-3 version, this symptom was listed as intolerance of being alone. That morphed into the DSM-5 version, which reads, frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Check out our online interview with Dr. Coit Khan for tips on how to manage this in your practice.
That's it. 10 questions. And you can see they map pretty well with the DSM criteria. The cutoff is 7, so patients who answer yes to at least 7 of those have an 80% chance of having borderline personality disorder. Well, sort of.
There's one more caveat to all this otherwise impressive research. We always need to understand sensitivity and specificity in terms of the population at hand. Suppose you have a great screening question for depression. It's, do you feel depressed a lot of the time? If you asked that to people in my waiting room, it would prove to be a pretty accurate test because the sample's pretty enriched for those with real depression. But if you asked it at random to everyday people at a farmer's market, its accuracy would go down, and its specificity and sensitivity would not be as good. So let's look at the kinds of people Mary Zanarini recruited for this particular screening study. She placed an ad in the papers that read, are you extremely moody? Do you often feel distrustful of others? Do you frequently feel out of control? Are your relationships painful and difficult? So everyone who took the screening test had already said yes to that big one. That means the test is only 80% accurate if the person has already said yes to those questions. And here's another interesting fact from the study. Of the 200 people she recruited who said yes to that lengthy question, 70% had confirmed borderline personality disorder. So my take on that, if you only had one screening question for borderline personality disorder, use that one. Oh, and one last thing about this screening test. They excluded people who had active substance abuse, bipolar 1, or a psychotic disorder. And they were right to do so. Those are the disorders that trump borderline personality. And in current guidelines, you're supposed to attend to those and treat those before trying to treat the borderline part. So in our online version of the rating scale, we put those in at the end. It wasn't in the original scale, but it serves as a useful reminder not to jump into borderline stuff if the basics haven't been addressed.
And now for the word of the day, hysterical psychosis.
Hysterical psychosis refers to transient psychotic symptoms that are thought to arise out of severe stress rather than a genuine psychotic disorder. You'll also hear this called pseudopsychosis sometimes, and it crops up a lot in the borderline literature. The term was widely used and researched in the 19th century, but it fell out of favor in the DSM era because of negative connotations around the word hysterical, which literally means wandering uterus. Hysterical psychosis was kind of replaced by brief reactive psychosis in DSM-3. And then DSM-4 further purified it, removing the word reactive, as they prefer not to imply any causation. And in DSM-4, it was called brief psychotic disorder, which stays with us today, and, well, it's really not quite the same as the old conception of hysterical psychosis, though. This hysterical psychosis, as you may have guessed, also shows up in the final 9th criteria for borderline personality disorder about transient stress-related psychotic symptoms. In psychodynamic terms, hysterical psychosis is viewed as a primitive coping mechanism similar to dissociation, and like dissociation, it might arise out of severe trauma. It's relevant to borderline personality disorder and to PTSD, because you'll often see these mild psychotic symptoms at the more severe ends of those disorders. These psychotic symptoms often have dreamlike qualities with prominent delusions and dissociations. The patients may appear delusional, but on closer inspection, it's really that they have trouble separating fantasy from reality. They tell fanciful, dramatic stories that they believe are true, such as having an imaginary boyfriend who's on the run from the FBI. And there's a psychiatric term for this as well, pseudologia fantastica, which means you make up stories that you believe are true. Altered states of consciousness, dissociation, and even multiple personalities are often part of the presentation and were described as part of hysterical psychosis back in the 19th century. That's right, they knew of multiple personality back then, and they saw it as a hysterical or extreme stress-related symptom. It's not known if this kind of psychosis responds to antipsychotics, but it may respond to psychotherapy. In the 19th century, Pierre Janet treated hysterical psychosis with hypnosis, and his success there inspired a young neurologist to go on to create a new type of talking cure, Sigmund Freud.
Join us next week for an interview with Lois Choi Kane, the do's and don'ts of working with borderline personality disorder. You can read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarlattreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You get $30 off your first year's subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
The Carlatt Report is one of few CME publications that is entirely supported by our readers. Thank you for helping us stay free of commercial and industry support.